Senate Republicans unveil their budget, prioritizing the protection of monuments, plus a major gun bill halted, and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending April 9th, 2021.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, the Indiana Senate released its version of the K-12 funding proposal for Indiana's next two-year state budget. From WFYI's Education Desk, Eric Weddle reports the draft dials back school choice programs favored by the House and increases funding for students in poverty.
Senate Republicans' proposal would double the amount of new funding for K-12 spending at $875 million compared to the House plan. About half of that would increase the per-student funding formula over the next 2 years. The plan would also boost the additional funds for students in poverty. That was in response to school leaders from across the state criticizing efforts by House lawmakers to flatline the funding. The Senate is eyeing fewer dollars for school choice, such as a smaller expansion of the private school voucher program. Yet, Gary Democratic Senator Eddie Melton still criticized it and attempted to amend the budget with no increase for school vouchers.
Traditional public schools educate 93% of Indiana's children, so 93% of our funding is in the formula goes to those schools.
Melton's amendment was voted down.
Is this the prudent path forward on education funding? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Elise Schrock. Republican Mike O'Brien. John Schwanis, host of Indiana Lawmakers. And Nikki Kelly, State House reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Mike O'Brien, does this put Indiana's students in a good place?
I think it does. We talk every year and you know, I get criticized a little bit for saying it's a historic amount of education funding every 2 years because that just naturally goes up. I may not be in that position anymore because I don't know that we'll ever spend this much money on K-12 education in Indiana. Part of that, $850 million increase just in the Senate Republican budget to K-12 alone. If you include higher ed, it's 61.2% of every 62 cents on every tax dollar that comes into the state is spent on education. $196 million more for special ed, and the $1.8 billion that's coming through CARES 3, or the third, whatever the third version of stimulus is, this year and next, and spread out across, you know, school districts all over the state. So that's in addition to the $150 million for learning loss, to the grant program that schools can apply for to try to help kids catch up from falling behind maybe in the last year when they were working remotely or some blend of that. So, yeah, I mean, it's a very healthy budget if you're just looking at the money. And there's some new programming. There's new education savings accounts. It was a big priority for the House Republicans that the Senate almost eliminated in terms of funding. They went from $150 million down to $3 million in these savings accounts that expand the school choice program. We'll probably see that just moderate itself and work its way back in. We also have the April 15th revenue forecast coming up this week, and there's been a commitment by, I think, leaders on all sides that that's going to go straight into the kind of the per pupil foundation money that's spent. So this may be the record going forward on education funding in the budget.
Is this a good education budget?
I'm certainly happier with the Senate version of the House, and I'll be very interested to see how that is reconciled because we still have a long way to go. I, of course, wish that we would have seen Senator Melton's amendments incorporated into this budget. He is such an authority and has such expertise when it comes to public ed funding. Would have liked to have seen that. One thing that I am happy to see in the Senate budget is the restoration of those CTE funds that ensure that students who are looking to go into culinary, cosmetology, broadcasting are still going to be on the right path to get into some of those fields. And I think that's really important right now. I hope to see it stay in the budget.
Yeah, we'll see. If you're a student out there who's interested in broadcasting, don't. I'm just kidding. Nikki Kelly, this does represent a pretty significant difference from the House Republican budget. We talked to the Speaker about that. What did they say in response to the Senate budget?
Well, I mean, I think the House Republicans were relatively happy with it. The Senate definitely focused less on the foundation and a little more on helping poor or disabled kids. And they still did. They opened up a brand new ESA program, though at a smaller level. They did slightly expand vouchers, though at a smaller level. I mean, I honestly think, like, when you look at it, there's something there for everyone. They increased some charter funding. So I'm, you know, all the education folks I talked to were very impressed at how it gave a little bit for everyone. And, you know, I think the Senate really listened. They had this marathon six-hour meeting on school funding, and it seemed to me like they really listened and took it to heart.
One thing notably absent from this budget, as it has been in the governor's budget and the House Republican budget, anything for teachers, anything new for teachers, I should say. Are you surprised that it looks like we'll reach the end of the 2021 session without any meaningful action on teacher pay raises?
Well, the response to that, certainly, as we heard earlier in the session from House budget architects, and now what we will hear, if we're not already hearing it from their Senate counterparts, is that with this additional funding, school boards, local school districts have the latitude to reward their teachers as they see fit and as they deem appropriate in terms of the competitive environment for their given community. And they often will repeat, and it's true, but they will repeat, much as you say that the budget's historic. They will often point out that we don't give pay raises directly to teachers. That's the prerogative of local officials, independently elected school board members, which is true. Now, we talked before about mechanisms by which you could force the issue to a greater extent. But I think this will stay still, because of the dollars that are being thrown at this, and because there is a little bit of something for anybody, for everybody, it really is going to take, I think, a little of the sting out that specific line item is there. Sure, teachers would want to see that. But knowing that this kind of money is going to be flowing into their classrooms and into their schools, there's a little something there for everybody.
And Senator Bray noted yesterday that a lot of the federal money that's going directly to schools that Mike, you mentioned, he's hoping that a chunk of that will be used directly for teacher pay raises. Well, the Senate Republican state budget proposal unveiled this week also begins to spend some of the new $3 billion in federal COVID-19 relief coming to the state of Indiana.
The Senate Republican budget plan would spend more than $800 million in federal dollars on programs ranging from police body cameras to water infrastructure and broadband expansion. Senate GOP budget architect Ryan Mishler says he doesn't want the state to spend all of the new federal money right away.
We may have some issues we don't even know about coming down the road, and so I think the responsible thing to do is to hold on to some of that.
Democratic Senator Eddie Melton would like to see federal money used to help Hoosier teachers.
Freeing up new dollars by leveraging some of the federal funding would allow our locals to increase teacher pay.
Senate Democrats, though, largely applauded Mishler's plans for the federal funds.
Elise Schrock, is $3 billion, and it can be spent any time between now and, I think, 2024. So is holding back some of this money a good move?
I don't know. I mean, this is pretty textbook State House Republican. They love to hold money back, but often it's done at the expense of Hoosiers who are in need. For example, I know we've talked on this show before about low-cost items that are simply not given funding that would have high impact for Hoosiers, specifically with the choice funding. That is an amendment that Senator Melton had that was voted down along party lines. Choice funding helps keep elderly and folks who need just a little extra care in their homes with dignity. It costs taxpayers 4% less than it would for them to go into long-term care. And it just a small 1% increase in this funding would have made the difference, and still they couldn't pass this amendment. So I think we really need to be investigating how to use this money sustainably rather than just racking it up like they've done in the past.
Both, I think it was Senator Mishler and Speaker Houston talked about they have numbers in mind of the $3 billion, a certain percentage that they know they want to spend this, you know, or at least say how they're going to spend it this session before they adjourn. But is holding back some of it appropriate?
I think it is, and I think we have another budget between now and when that money, it's two state budget cycles where those dollars can be invested. But we do, and to continue what we hear from State House Republicans is that what we're not going to do is fund all these things that Democrats have proposed that are ongoing expenses, some of them, knowing that this money is going to run out. So, I mean, if local school corporations get this $1.7 plus billion, and they're able to build it into their, you know, into their budgets. I think what you're going to see the school districts not do is build it into teacher compensation, that because there's no guarantee that in 2 years there's more money coming to help them continue funding that. And that's always the challenge with these huge pots of money. And it's the reason we have $500 trillion in state budget deficits coming out of COVID. And what you're going to have is a lot of states are going to do exactly what State House Democrats want the budget writers to do, which is to build this into the budget as an ongoing expense. And then in 2 or 3 years, 2024 runs around, the money's gone, and now we're back to the federal government. And when that money comes in, it's going to have strings attached to it. You're going to give the federal government a large influence over how your budgets are created, and not in a way that's going to make them balanced like we've had now in Indiana for a long time. And so they're very cautious about building that, spending these dollars too fast or spending on things that are ongoing expenses.
John, if you listen to Senator Mishler there, he's worried about, we don't know what's coming. You know, the pandemic certainly isn't over. So holding on to some of this money for whatever that next thing is appropriate. Do you think the average Hoosier hears that and goes, yeah, that's okay?
Human nature probably dictates that people, especially people who are hurting economically because of the pandemic, probably are saying, gee, it's great to marshal, you know, and be good stewards of resources, but I need help now. And certainly for those who are hurting and struggling, and there are a lot of people out there who fall into that category, I'm sure they're desperate for the help and they need it now. So it's hard to look at sit back and deliberate about what makes best fiscal sense in the long term. I do think Republicans can point with justification to the approach that they have taken, and by that I mean keeping healthy reserves, did position, as Mike suggested, the state very well vis-a-vis its counterparts across the country. A lot of states would do anything to trade their fiscal situation right now with that of Indiana, and that's because we did have some reserves. In terms of giving it out, once we get all the COVID money out of the way, if the Biden administration is successful, and presumably through budget reconciliation, it may well be with another $2.3 trillion in infrastructure, the Republicans in this state may have trouble. There's just so much money coming through the pipeline. There's going to have to be almost a situation where you can't give it away fast enough, which would be
you got to hire people to go spend it. Then what do you do with it when it's gone?
These are also relief funds, so it's not necessarily that these are going to be ongoing. We're trying to get people back to where they were pre-COVID, and so some of these, like I said, the choice funding is an actual taxpayer savings. So we just have to be smart about how we're doing this, and that doesn't always mean just Scrooge McDucking your money for a later time.
But you can, like, a lot of this money is capital expense for building it. And the same thing with education. It may be that the easiest way to placate Republicans who are concerned about ongoing expenses is to see that let's put some things into brick and mortar, whether it's in the health arena or the education arena, and then that's arguably a one-time expense.
It frees up money, right. All right, well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, should the state hold back some of the new federal COVID-19 relief dollars for future needs? A, yes, or B, no. Last week's question, will Governor Holcomb ever reimpose any statewide COVID-19 restrictions? Just 38% of you say yes, 62% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR. And look for the poll. Well, legislation sent to the governor this week prioritizes protecting monuments and statues across the state, even cutting off some funding from local governments that don't. The legislation requires the state police to prioritize investigation of anyone who damages or just vandalizes a monument, memorial, statue, or other commemorative property, both public and private. Democratic Representative Robin Shackelford is troubled by that.
This bill is saying we would rather catch a vandal for defacing a statue over a predator who has molested a child.
But Republican Representative Matt Lehman says the bill doesn't say what prioritize means.
That could be the bottom of my priorities. Nothing in here says it's got to be the top priority. You put everything else aside and focus solely on monuments.
The bill also says if local governments don't prioritize protecting monuments, the state can withhold some funding. Shackelford says that includes dollars that flow to local law enforcement. In essence, she says, defunding the police.
Nikki Kelly, did Matt Lehman undercut the bill a little bit when trying to explain it?
Yeah, I mean, there's really no way to see that, right? Because, I mean, what's the point of the bill if they can all say, well, we prioritized it last? I mean, I think it's an interesting discussion because it is, I think, a fair criticism to say, what are we prioritizing it over? You know, are we prioritizing it over, you know, violent crime or things like that? It also has some language in there to increase the felony, you know, that they can go to jail for if you damage, you know, a monument or something like that. It also talks about private
commemorative property
materials, and there was some discussion about would that count if I'm literally hanging, you know, a Confederate flag out and someone comes and takes it? Do they have to prioritize that crime?
Does this bill make a lot of sense to you?
Maybe the intent. Certainly, I understand where people, the advocates, are coming from, but it is open to misinterpretation or various interpretations, not only because of the notion of prioritization. We'll stipulate that. But then the other thing is, and you were just touching on this, Nikki, is what constitutes a memorial or some sort of commemorative? Could it be a monument to something that Matt Lehman and others would find despicable and horrible? But does that mean, therefore, that state police would throw their arms around that thing in support, even though he and I'm sure many in the Republican caucus would say that's not what we had in mind when we promoted this bill? So there's just a lot open to interpretation.
I feel like I keep quoting Ed Delaney on weeks when Ann Delaney isn't here. But to quote Ed Delaney, he called this a message bill. Is it a message bill? And if it is that the problem, that they're trying to take a message bill but actually apply it in law, and that's where it gets tricky?
Well, it's a political flashpoint, right? So yeah, I mean, the two sides, people disagree on these things. I think this issue of the issue of memorials, I'm not for a mob tearing these things down overnight. You know, but I also don't think if you were like an avowed racist and supporter of the Civil War, you get to have the biggest statue in town forever and ever through the end of human history. I mean, there's got to be some kind of like context, some kind of thoughtful conversation about what is it we choose to memorialize and celebrate in this country, and what maybe did we 150 years ago that's not nearly appropriate anymore. And both parties are going to look at things as examples for those things. But the debate has just it's so polarized that you can't even talk about, for Republicans, moving a statue or whether we should continue to have one of these up. And Democrats want them all, you know, torn down if they did anything that was offensive in history, you know, on the extremes. And then I think there's a lot of people in between that are like, these are case-by-case basis and conversations we need to have.
I think this was raised in the floor debate on this bill, which is the idea of there's opt-outs for the local government language in terms of cutting off funding. There's opt-outs and ways you can avoid that happening. Is this a bill that's simply never going to be used?
Well, first of all, we already had laws protecting property. So this is, I just don't think it is any coincidence that this bill is coming the session after we saw a summer of many months of Hoosiers of all backgrounds coming out to demand for racial justice. Sure, we passed 1006, and I'm not demeaning that. That was a historic criminal justice bill. But at the same time, this same body is prioritizing monuments after a year of protests. I mean, if that's your takeaway from these protests and that's what you're hearing from Hoosiers, that's a problem. So I do think it is a reaction to that. I think it's supposed to send that message. I think that floor speech was a prime example of when you're explaining, you're losing, and Hoosiers prioritize a lot more than these monuments.
Well, legislation that would eliminate Indiana's licenses to carry a handgun in public is likely dead this session. Still, legislative leaders wouldn't rule out reviving the bill before lawmakers head home.
The Senate did not give the handgun license elimination bill a hearing before Thursday's deadline to do so. And as a kind of compromise, Senate Republicans included in their budget proposal eliminating the fee for a lifetime handgun carry permit. House Speaker Todd Houston says his caucus prefers eliminating the licenses entirely.
If we end up removing the lifetime permit fee, that's at least a positive step forward.
If the lifetime permit does become free, Senate President Pro Tem Roderick Bray says those who've already paid for one shouldn't expect a refund.
You know, I've got mine as well and don't expect a refund there. So we're not really talking about that.
Bray wouldn't say what the possibility is that total handgun license elimination could be restored before the session ends.
John Schwanes, is the handgun license bill dead?
Learned a long time ago, and it's a cliche, but it's true. Nothing's ever dead. Now, the rules would suggest that when the budget or anything goes to conference committee, that fair game, the fodder for, that could go into the bill is limited to something that's passed one chamber. But we all know and can point to examples where miraculously, mysteriously, even things that haven't passed a chamber sometimes get in. So that's a long-winded way of saying I have no idea, and I'm not going to make a bet because as soon as I do, I'll be proven wrong.
I'm going to ask you to make a prediction, though. Do you think the bill is dead this session?
I think it's pretty dead. I mean, it's fascinating that a bill that had 21 co-sponsors in the Senate, all Republicans, you know, wasn't heard. And yet, Senator Bray made clear that he didn't kill the bill. His caucus decided, which meant people who signed on to the bill didn't want to hear it. It's a little odd. The main issue they said they had a problem with was this database that it creates of prohibited persons. That could have easily been removed. I mean, if that's your problem, you know, it could have moved forward, but they chose not to have that discussion at all.
Although you remove that, and the law enforcement community is even more upset about the bill than
they were already against it.
Yeah, they were already against it. That's true. I want to ask about the issue that Nikki just raised, which is 21 co-sponsors in the Senate. That's more than half of the Republican caucus. And yet, he said it was a caucus decision. Make the two of those make sense.
It's like a convention fight when you're, you know, when your vote count is twice as many as the delegates in the room. You know, everyone's for you, and then they go in the booth and push the button. That's it. I mean, it's in part why you have these conversations behind closed doors. You're kind of free of the pressure and maybe make a better decision than whatever group's bringing the, you know, pushing you on the issue. That there's positives and negatives. If you're not for that this bill, then you're for the Senate Republican caucus making that decision behind closed doors. That's not always the case, I understand, but it worked in this situation.
All right. Well, the University of Notre Dame will require all students to get a COVID-19 vaccine before returning for the fall 2021 semester. WVPE's Gemma DiCarlo has more.
In a letter to the campus community, university officials announced undergraduate, graduate, and professional students will all need to be fully vaccinated before returning to campus in the fall. That's unless they have a documented medical or religious exemption. University spokesperson Dennis Brown says faculty and staff will be strongly encouraged to get vaccinated, but as of now, they won't be required to.
Willie Schrock, is it fair to require this of students and not the faculty and staff?
You know, it's tough because there aren't, you know, federal and state guidelines don't require you to make your employees get the vaccine, so it is tough. There are religious issues that could be at play here. I mean, as a religious person, I think the most loving thing that you can do is protect your neighbor, and you can get the vaccine as soon as it's presented to you. So that's my personal take on it. So when you're not getting that guideline from federal or state, or even at the state level, we saw early on in session, actually, we saw legislation filed so that you wouldn't be able to do this. It's really hard to ask that of institutions.
Yeah, the religious or medical opt-outs that are in part of Notre Dame's policy are already in federal and I believe even state law. That bill earlier this session would have expanded it to moral or ethical reasons, I think. Are you surprised that we haven't seen action out of the State General Assembly when it comes to requiring vaccines?
We could have this. This is going to be a question with employers, with schools for a long time. You know, whether, you know, we'll see how successful we are at herd immunity and these other things to curb this this pandemic, which I think will motivate the policy, you know, what kind of actual, like, health policies and mandates we see come out of that. We're going to deal with this question. Every employer that ever has to make a decision on whether or not they're going to require their employees to come back to work with a vaccine is going to be controversial, I think.
Yeah, quickly, to that point, are we about to see the private sector start to have this conversation, whether behind closed doors or not, a lot?
Absolutely. Absolutely, this question's going to go on. I mean, a lot of it's framing. What Notre Dame probably could do is say, we have two options. You go back to the classroom, you go to football games, and enjoy college the way your counterparts used to, or we do things remotely. I think if you frame it in that context, a lot of people say, here, sign me up, put it right in here right now.
All right. Well, that is Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Elise Schrock, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/IWIR. Or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Stay safe, stay healthy. Please still wear a mask and get vaccinated as soon as you can, which I did this week. And join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.